Have you heard one of those yet, Heather?
I haven't. I haven't. I'm eagerly awaiting them, though.
Yes, that is the sound of the red-winged blackbird. We have just started to hear them near Stillwater, but they're moving their way north. You're up in Bemidji.
I'm up in Bemidji, and we can hear them. They're very, very loud. Along our bike trail right in Bemidji that goes around the lake, and that's always one of the most like welcoming sounds of spring, I would say.
Absolutely. Yeah. Welcoming and kind of like a shrill and they're feisty. They'll take a swoop at you if you're like wearing a red hat or they perceive you as a threat.
Really? I have never had one swipe at me, so maybe I look bird friendly. I don't know.
Maybe. I had a friend when I was in grad school at Iowa State, who was wearing a red Iowa State hat when she would go out for her runs at Turtle Camp every summer.
Turtle Camp? And
Turtle Camp, where I did my research. When she would go for runs in like May and June, she would sometimes get red-winged blackbirds like dive bombing her because of her red hat.
Wow.
They saw it as like, I think, a intruding other male or something. I don't know.
I'm not
a red-winged blackbird. But
I never thought about that before. Oh my gosh. That is so cool. And a mm-hmm. little bit frightening.
Right? Oh, Heather, who are you? What do you do for KAXE?
That's a very good question. Well, I'm Heather Johnson. I'm the membership coordinator here at KAXE KBXE. So I'll take your credit card information. I will... You know, send you a friendly greeting, a thank you card, and anything else you might like. And sometimes I'm on the morning show. I'm all over the place.
You do all sorts of things for us, and we greatly appreciate it. But yes, your thank you cards are particularly appreciated by us and by all of our members. So thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is the Season Watch podcast. That's Heather Johnson. I'm Charlie Mitchell. Look at me remembering to intro ourselves. You know, without
so
Heidi, I just get a little lost.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Charlie, yeah. Our wonderful phenology coordinator.
I try. Mostly just nature nerd who ended up here somehow, but I'm happy to be here. To start this week, we have a phenology report from our friends at Little Falls that I wanted to listen to together.
This is Jay and Thomas reporting from Little Falls Middle School. This is our phenology report for the week of March 15th. Our most intriguing discovery this past week was a pair of small grasshoppers that a classmate found. We have always thought that all grasshoppers died in the fall after laying eggs, but apparently a small amount of nymphs will hibernate through the winter.
Mr. Kucher had an exciting discovery at his house as he saw a saw-what owl that is hanging around. He heard the call for several days and thought it was an alarm at first, before investigating and learned the real source.
There were three pileated woodpeckers that were spotted on the same tree.
The sugar maple sap has been running, and people have been collecting and making maple syrup.
The leaves of the tulips popping up in the courtyard of our school against the south-facing walls.
We saw our first wood ducks of the year on the 8th as three individuals were spotted.
One mystery this week was the discovery of very small blue eggs in a wood duck box. The box was cleaned out early last fall, and we are confused about where they came from.
We had an observation of a group of crows chasing and swooping at a red-tailed hawk.
We got a great trail camera video of a bobcat and a mystery animal that climbed a tree to avoid it, and we think it was a mink.
The new shallow snow we have gotten on several nights has allowed us to see how quickly the voles establish their trails.
That is our report for this week. Until next week, keep exploring,
keep discovering,
and keep connecting with the great outdoors.
I love those student updates. Wow, they saw a ton of activity.
Right? I know, all of those different notes. I did choose this one particularly for you because of the insects. They found those grasshopper nymphs.
Yes.
And Heather, you love insects.
I do. I love. My phone is probably has as many pictures of insects as it does of my son.
A good ratio.
I mean, I think so.
Do you have any favorites?
Oh, favorite insects? Butterflies and moths, obviously, big favorite. Probably won't see them for a few more weeks, I would assume.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a little
especially
bit
up in Bemidji. Yeah.
Yeah. I do love to see any caterpillar I can find, which will be even later still, I assume. What else? Grasshoppers are great. The little leaf hoppers I really enjoy. They're so tiny.
Oh, yeah. Which I hadn't, like, really recognized. Leaf hopper wasn't a, like, word in my brain.
Sure.
Until recently. Maybe this isn't a problem for most people. This is a problem for me, where I end up bringing home, like, a new field guide every time I go to, like, any park or place that has a gift shop with field guides.
It's an obsession.
This time I went to the Saxon Bog and ended up returning home with Insects of the North Woods.
Yes, I have that one.
By Jeffrey Hahn. Yeah. And it had a whole section on leafhoppers that I was like, oh, you're right. That is a like distinct group of critters. So what does a leafhopper look like?
Well, they're a little bitty. And the ones that I usually see up here have
the technical term, little bitty.
They have sort of a red and blue, like electric blue shield on their backs. And they're very pretty. I always have to zoom in to appreciate all the detail on them. And yes, I see them on coneflower really often. And on the black-eyed Susans, and just kind of all over my garden later in the year, of course. But mm-hmm. I love them. Let's see, what else? The big grasshoppers, of course, like we talked about, yeah. They are garden friends. But my number one, always the bees. A lot of times I will hear the ground nesting ones before I see them. In our yard, anyway, I was like, oh, that's buzzy. Maybe I shouldn't go over there right now.
Interesting. Do you get to see them, like, dig out their little nests or anything?
Well, every now and then, you'll just kind of come across, it's basically just a little hole in the ground. And yeah, you'll see them just mm-hmm. kind of buzzing out and flying out. They love our yard, so I think that's a good sign. But instead of the native plants, I often see them on the oregano. For some reason, they love it. And the oregano is taking over the yard, by the way. Don't ever let that loose in your yard. but yes, those are other gardening buddies. And I love the way they sound and how they feel when they fly by your head and hopefully not into your mm-hmm. hair, because that happened once.
The trials of having long hair.
Yes. Flew right into the poof on my head and had a hard time working it out. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you manage to get it out without getting stung or without bee getting injured?
Yeah, absolutely. It just took a little bit of patience. I just kind of, I'm sure my neighbors, if they saw it, thought it was hilarious that I was lying face down on the ground encouraging this bee to get out of my hair. But yes, it got out.
Amazing.
It was totally fine. I have never been stung. Never. My years communing mm-hmm. with bees, I've never been stung. So
I don't think I've ever been stung by a bee. I've been stung by wasps and hornets, mostly because, I'm a child of trouble. and was like, ooh, look at the cool bug. And then maybe probably got a little too close to the nest, etc. But never by a bee. And like the bumblebees, you can like, I don't know. Okay, you probably share this compulsion. Other people seem to think that this compulsion is strange for some reason. But, the bumblebees are so fuzzy and you want to feel how fuzzy they are. Yes. And so you just want to go give them a little pet on their back if they're staying still. And I've done that plenty of times and never gotten stung. They're quite friendly.
They are. And some of them are huge. I think especially at the beginning of the season. Correct me if I'm wrong. They're one of the three-color bees, one of the banded,
tricolor?
One of the tricolor bees.
Or the belted?
Belted, yeah. I think, more than, what's mm-hmm. the rare one with the, it has?
Oh, yeah, the rare one, the little friend, the buddy, the rusty-patched. There we go.
we do get those, but those are smaller. I feel like the ones at the beginning mm-hmm. of the season, and I could be wrong, but they're especially large when you see them mm-hmm. emerge and definitely, it's like a tiny little cat you just want to pet.
I know. So cute. Okay, so you've got a garden. What are the first plants that you see?
Besides quackgrass, I usually see the prairie smoke coming up. So I have native gardens. I was lucky mm-hmm. enough to get a grant to put in a second one just a couple of years ago.
Oh, is that the Lawns to Legumes
program? Lawns to Legumes, yes. And it was wonderful because I got to buy plants instead of seeds, and it just takes off so much faster that way. One of the first things I see usually emerging is prairie smoke, and the prairie smoke has been spreading like crazy, so I've had to move it around, which is great.
What does prairie smoke look like when it pops up? Because we don't have much of it around here. I think we're too shaded. It's more of a prairie plant, right?
I would assume so. And it grows, it must really flourish in poor soil. At least it does at my house because it's very, very sandy. They're sort of frilly, long leaves that stay close to the ground. And then later, the stems will pop up and they will be a pretty bright pink. And they have sort of a tulip sort of shaped flower before they're open. And then they open into kind of a beautiful sort of a troll doll head, really.
cute.
Because
okay.
It has, it's sort of a smoke.
A poof.
Well, yeah, hence the name, sort of a poof of smoke with these long tendrils of fuzzy pink that come up out of the main flower head.
So is that the flower or the seed that gets the name prairie smoke? Or is it kind of a bit of both? They both kind of have a poofy look.
I think it's just the flower because the seeds, if I recall correctly, that's the other part of this, they're pretty tiny and they're attached to each of those little flower petals. Petals as
tendrils?
Such. Tendrils, yeah. That's probably a better word for it. So mine don't get very tall. I've seen pictures of the ones that get very, very tall in the, prairie. But mine stay probably around 6 to 8 inches, I would say, throughout the season when they're blooming. But I see those come up first. Oh, what else? Definitely the echinacea are already getting green under the snow. And we just got a fresh layer of snow. And the black-eyed Susans, too, with their fuzzy leaves are coming out. It's all alive under there already.
Absolutely.
They know it's spring already. We're still waiting a few days. So.
And what insects are the first ones to move into your garden?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think I noticed the ants first.
So do the woodpeckers.
Yep. And having all that sandy soil, you really do get a lot of ants. Let me think about what could come. There might be a few moths that come out fairly early, like the morning cloak, I think. They overwinter, don't they?
Yeah, that's a butterfly, the morning cloaks.
Right, right.
But the infant moth is the one that John talks about a lot.
Okay.
But yeah, the morning cloak butterflies come out early. They overwinter as adults. Compton's tortoiseshell?
Yes, for sure. I don't see a lot of those right around me, but if we go not too far away on a walking trail, we can catch those sometimes. Mm-hmm. I want to say there's a fritillary that comes out early. Is that right?
I'll believe it. I'm not very good at my butterflies. I got to admit.
So here's the thing about those insect guides. I have to, and this is really the butterfly, I think it's even combined butterfly and moth guide. I have to look at those every year because I'm like, is it this one or that one? So, and the same thing with some of the flowers I see on our trails around here, the early ones. Oh, in the state park, I'll see bloodroot come out early. That's kind of a treat. They are very beautiful.
In my area, the first plants to pop up just in our forest, the hepatica, I think they're also called liverleaf, but I call them hepatica, are the first ones to kind of come up and see their flowers.
And those are the tiny, they're the tiny ones, right?
Yeah, they're just little and they're all fuzzy.
They
just look like they've got like little fur coats on against the cold. And their leaves are evergreen, and they're kind of like thicker. They've got very sturdy leaves to last all winter. But at the end of the winter, I think they kind of turn almost purplish. I think it must be some sort of like sunscreen that they're putting into the leaves to help deal with all of that pretty intense sunlight. And then the new leaves pop up and they're just as green as they can be. The bloodroot follows not long after that. And you had mentioned that your neighbors have bloodroot, but you do not yet?
Oh, I don't know if my neighbors do, but not too far away. There's bloodroot.
Not too far away.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's none in my yard. It just doesn't want to grow in my yard for whatever reason. Yet.
You said you have sandy soil.
Yeah.
And a lot of ants. And so bloodroot, their seeds are actually spread by ants. If you look at the right time, so once the flower has finished and starts developing its seeds, the seeds kind of grow in this almost pea-looking pod. And if you make it at the right time, you can find the seeds when they're ripe, but before the ants have harvested them. And you'll see a little tiny brown seed with this white tube attached to the side. That white tube is called an elaiosome, and it is kind of full of fat and nutrients that the ants really want. Oh. So the ants go out and they harvest these seeds and they bring them back to their ant nest, and they detach that like little food portion, feed it to their larvae, and then the rest of the seed is basically of no use to the ant, so they take it and they put it in their compost heap, because ants are very tidy like that. And for the bloodroot, by like kind of paying the ant for the transportation services, the seed gets put into this place where it's going to grow really well. And so when John transplanted a bloodroot plant into his yard, he waited like a couple years for it to, and then all of a sudden it started popping up 10 feet away, another ways away, but like at a good distance where the seed itself would be unlikely to travel that far,
sure,
but always near an anthill. And I just think, and there's a lot of these spring ephemerals that use this like ant reciprocal relationship with these ants to move their seeds around. I think Trillium do. There are a number of them. I just think that's so cool.
So reciprocal relationship is so much better than what I was going to call it, which is antspertation. So
I would argue that is perfect. Antspertation.
I did not know that.
Love that so much.
So interesting.
Isn't that awesome?
I have to take back all the bad things I've said about ants over the years. Mostly, I just don't like them in my house. But
there is that.
Do you know if there's a specific type of ant that is maybe most beneficial for carrying those types of seeds, or that wants that fatty nutrient more than others?
I don't know for sure. My inclination would be that there are likely some species-specific relationships going on between different species of ants and species of plants that like specialize in harvesting seeds from this particular plant, would be my gut feeling. But I would have to go dig into some things to find out, which of course now I really want to do. But I'm pretty sure that this has been studied pretty extensively once they like discovered this mutual relationship. They've really been digging into it, and I'm pretty sure there's some pretty strong species interactions there between plants and ants. Plants and ants.
Plants and ants. Well, that's so great. Now, I'll have to be grateful when I have the ants around me when I'm trying to pull that quack grass out of my native beds.
I am not familiar with quack grass, but I really hope it involves ducks somehow.
It does not. It is not charming and cute or feathered or anything. No, you are not familiar with quack grass. You are so lucky. It has, I'm sure there's a better, more a scientific term for it, but its root can go on for just forever. And so you can pull and pull and pull on one. And I mean, I think truly they can go maybe miles, certainly yards.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Ilimus repens, says my quick Google. Introduced in the United States, of course.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at the map to see what its range is. Oh, everywhere. Cool. All through Minnesota, up into Canada.
Yeah. Oh, I have such a good
little
place
guy, and
for
get
you
back
to
you.
Start. You can pull up miles of it. Come on over.
Perfect. Oh man, yeah, that's got to be hard if the root system is like that. It's even something like Creeping Charlie. Great name, by the way. It's just so hard to eradicate.
It's a great name. It smells really good too. I actually don't mind the Creeping Charlie. We have that as well, and I kind of leave it alone. I don't find it aggressive, and because we are on that sand, it is pretty easy to pull up weeds there. So that's one good thing about having almost no nutrients in your soil. If you can find one positive, that would be it.
So with your gardening, like, what's some signs that you look for that it's like really time to get into gardening gear and get out there and start planting or weeding? Or what's your first step? Do you start things indoors?
I used to when I had a little bit more time, and I would start things out of doors too with winter sowing, especially those things that need that frost and freezing period.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, most of, I would say, our native plants do need that to break open the hard seed shell. But I didn't do any this year. It was on my list to do, and then I don't know. Everything kind of gets
life
in the way, pretty much.
Yep.
when it dries out so that I can be out there and not get soaking wet, you know, moving plants around and things. But also it's just kind of like when your heart tells you that you need to go outside and dig in the dirt for a while. It's almost like your whole body is saying, this is good for you, and you need to go out and, and get the sunshine and get the dirt under your finger. Well, and for me, under my fingernails, just all over me because I'm a mess.
But yep.
It's so wonderful with the native beds. When they're filling in like this, it just feels so rewarding because it starts off very sparse. It's not like, you know, planting a whole bunch of annuals and you've got your beautiful marigolds in a few weeks and they're all bunched together and it looks full and everything. It's kind of scraggly for a while. You have to wait. And I love my coneflowers and my black-eyed Susans because they just proliferate like crazy, and you can move them around, and then it's pretty instant gratification to see those coming in, and they're not really very picky. The birds like them, the insects like them, I like them. You're just rewarded with more and more of that activity the more of those you have. And then I have other cool things hopefully coming in, like
snake root. Or are you talking about Rattlesnake Master?
Rattlesnake Master, yes. Should be coming in this year, too. And that's
And what does Rattlesnake Master look like?
It's spiky. It looks maybe poisonous or dangerous, but it's very beautiful. And I think it's the flower itself is the spiky part. Is that right?
Okay.
The flower, or is it just the center? It may be just the center.
So Rattlesnake Master, for me, so when I started at KEXE, started learning from John Latimer, I knew a lot about science and very little about, like, what actually is that thing that I'm looking at out there. And so the learning curve has just been so steep. What I've discovered is that it takes me about 3 or 4 years to go from learning to identify a plant to recognizing it.
Sure.
So the first year, I'm like, using Seek and using a field guide and being like, okay, here's this mystery plant that I've never met before. What the heck is it? Identify yourself, please. And they never do, so you have to look it up.
So rude.
I know. Explain yourself. I always feel like kind of a cop when I'm like just going around being like, show your ID. Who are you?
I'm going to take your picture.
I'm going to take your picture. I'm going to refer back to my records. So like the first year I'm kind of doing that, and I'm probably doing that more than once throughout the season.
Yeah.
And maybe by the end of the season, I can like learn to recognize it. By the next season, it's gone. I have to do that again, but generally only for like the first couple months. And then I have it for the rest of the season. The next year, I have to remind myself once, and then it's in there.
Yep.
And then the fourth year, it can pop up and I recognize it right away. It takes time. And Rattlesnake Master, I'm on my third year. So I'll recognize it when I see it, probably, but I wouldn't be able to describe it off the top of my head. I remember the leaf is kind of triangular, almost, and has some, like, serrations or spikes on it, but I wouldn't be able to tell you the flower, because ours are in the deep forest, and I don't see them flower as much.
Okay.
I kind of wonder whether they're waiting for, like, an opening.
Oh, it could be. We're really lucky around Bemidji. We have these, I guess, pocket gardens at various places, even just downtown, which is fantastic. And it is a trend that I love and support. I'm really lucky to be able to see those bloom. And I know what's in there. And in some places, they are beautifully labeled as well, which I love. So that's really nice. And so even right here at the station, we're really close to a beautiful native bed. And that usually gets cooking pretty early because it has some really, really nice sunlight down here. So then I can spy on that and see what mine might look like in a week or two.
Have a little preview.
Exactly. Well, this is the nicest thing.
That's great.
To be able to, you know, it's the downtown, the heart of the city and everything, but to have those pockets of prairie and then the butterflies are just right there as well. It's so nice.
This conversation is making me feel so hopeful for spring, especially after, you know, we just got this huge amount of snow.
Yeah,
it was like kind of looking spring-like out there. And then this huge snow came and it was cold. And now I think overnight it was -6. And on Saturday, in just a few days, it's supposed to be 70 degrees down here.
70. Wow. I think we are in the mid-40s, I believe, right now mm-hmm. in Bemidji, and it's going to stay warm through the weekend. I bet we'll get mm-hmm. close to 60, but not 70 up here.
I'm hoping I'll see some butterflies Saturday.
Yeah. Well, that would be really nice, wouldn't it? I need to go out and see what's out there because I'm so ready for spring. Winter gets a little old after a certain point, and you're kind of looking mm-hmm. at the calendar going, is this longer than last year? Is this longer than any year?
Well, you know, winter does have some sweetness to it, which John Latimer reminded us of today. He was talking about where to find some, like, sweet little natural lollipops on the maple trees.
Natural lollipops.
As far as plants go, I was out with the children the other day, found an icicle hanging from a broken branch on a box elder. And a box elder is a maple. I picked the icicle and I bit off a little bit and I could taste a little sugar in it. And once I mentioned that there was sugar in it, why the kids were a little, looked at me a bit askance when I offered them a bit of ice from an icicle off of a tree. But once I told them it had a little bit of sweetness in it, why they all wanted to taste. And so if you come across a box elder or a maple that has a broken or injured branch and there's an icicle there, pick it off. The sweetest part is going to be down at the bottom because sugar freezes at a lower temperature than water, or sugary water freezes at a lower temperature, and it's going to run down that icicle and drip off the end, and that's where you're going to find the sweetness. So box elder, maples have opposite branches. So do the ash trees, but if you find an icicle on the ash, I doubt that you'll find much sugar in there, so look for opposite branches. Look for the absence of big, dark gray-brown buds. The box elder has brown buds, and the red maples and silver maples have red buds. The sugar maple has brown buds, but none of them look like the ash bud. It's a totally different type of bud. If you find an icicle, try it. You'll know right away if it's a maple or an ash.
Love the idea of John and a bunch of kids out there just like tasting the ends of icicles.
I want pictures. Number one, I want pictures of this. This is very intriguing. I never knew.
Intriguing. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I never knew that a box elder is a maple. It's in the maple family.
Yeah, very closely related. I also didn't know this until John Latimer and trying to teach myself all of nature and like as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
The seeds on a box elder look very much like the like helicopter samaras of maple trees, which is how I kind of remember that the two are similar.
That is so cool. It's also a good reminder that not every tree popsicle,
sure,
is going to be delicious. So, especially with kids, I would assume. Such a charming moment, I would assume. Here, taste this icicle.
Right. And it also like recontextualized for me. There have been a couple times that I've watched chickadees like perch on the very tip of a branch and drink the water dripping off from the icicle. And every time I've thought, oh, they're thirsty. This is so cute.
Yes.
That the like tiny little chickadee is sipping on the drop at the end of an icicle. But now I'm like thinking, oh, are they also after the sugar?
I've seen that as well, and I just thought they were, you know, showing off that they're the cutest creatures
exactly.
in the world.
Yeah. But, like, a little bit of early season nectar makes so much sense that it's, sweet.
Oh, my gosh. I never made that connection that it would be sweet. That's fantastic.
Right? Nature... Thanks, John Latimer.
Thanks, John. Yeah. Nature's confectionery.
Exactly. Oh, nature is confection. I'm looking out right now at all of our maple sap buckets. It's flowing today. And, we got our first batch of maple syrup in this last weekend. By we, I mean my mom and dad. And it's just so exciting. Thanks, nature.
Yeah. What do you think about the harvest this year? Do you think it'll be a good year for the sap to flow?
So far, it's been pretty decent. So ideal for maple sap is below freezing at night, above freezing during the day. And we have had a couple of spells of it being just below freezing or just above freezing. But we've still been getting plenty. It's enough for us to have a batch ready. And we started February 28th. So 2 weeks one batch. So hopefully we'll get two more batches in.
Nice.
We'll see. But the next week looks like it's going to be really good with the right kind of temperature swings. So I'm hoping.
The galvanized bucket collection, or what do you use?
So my parents are friends with some folks who had a restaurant, and they got a bunch of these like food grade plastic buckets. They're attached to these like really old metal spiles that have been in use for over 40 years. This is our 40th year tapping. Yeah, these metal spiles, which are just like rugged. I love them. They make my hands so happy because, you know, I've been handling these since I was 2 or whatever. Yeah. And then a little plastic tube that goes from the spile into the bucket. And then it all gets collected into a 90-gallon pan. We cook it outside until it gets like a little bit closer to syrup. We boil it all down and then finish it off inside. Okay. By which I mean, thank you, Barb, for finishing it off inside.
Mm-hmm. That is so cool. And there is something about the old equipment, just those things that are useful for so long. You know, there aren't that many of those things anymore. So it is really special when you have those moments of handling them and using them and just thinking about all the years behind them, decades behind
Absolutely.
Them. That's so cool. Yep.
And when we tap the trees, you know, we could use a drill, like a powered drill, and it would be quicker, etc. But we've been using this old, like, metal turn, the kind you, like, press against your chest and then turn.
Yep.
And that's how it's always been done. And it would feel so, like, wrong somehow to switch to hand drill now.
Sure.
I love it. It means so much to me. And, like, all of these trees have been feeding me my entire life, you know?
It's that process. That process. That's the way it's done. You can't deviate. Yeah. Well, I hope you get lots this year.
Me too. Yeah. I'm very grateful to be living where I do and to have grown up like doing this. A lot of good reasons why I turned out to be a nature nerd. But one of the things we look for at the end of the season is when we start getting like flies and insects in the buckets, that tells us it's about time for us to quit. And the flies and insects start coming out right around the time that you start hearing the frogs calling, which is the way that the indigenous people knew it was time to stop, was they would listen for the frogs calling and then they would stop tapping. And I just think it's interesting how we kind of both arrived at the same conclusion with different phenology, like cues. But it also makes sense that those frogs are coming out right around the same time as the insects, because chomp chomp.
Right. Or gulp gulp.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's another great sign of spring. The frog eggs. Little clutches.
Yeah.
Are they clutches for frogs?
Yeah. Balls. Clutches.
Yeah.
I'll believe it.
That's another kind of a magical thing to see if you can catch it. Oh, there's so much to look forward to.
Indeed. Speaking of magic, we have one more clip that we wanted to share, and that is about the magical looking wood duck. And if you haven't seen one of those, I recommend Googling it right now. They are gorgeous. And one of the first friends to show up of the ducks.
I was looking up some stuff on nest boxes, and I was surprised at the low percentage of reproduction that they really represent. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, for sure. So, and again, this goes back to what region you're in. So let's focus on Minnesota. If you're in, you know, kind of a prairie transition area of Minnesota, you might have a much higher nest box use. In our region, it's fairly low. I don't have the number right off the top of my head. But if you were to kind of flip it on its head and look at what actually wood ducks are using, so we marked wood ducks with transmitters over the last 4 or 5 years and tracked them to their nest site, kind of irregardless of where they're nesting. We're just trapping them out in the, you know, in the woods and wetlands across Cass County, so they could all select nest boxes if they wanted to. But we only found 2% selecting nest boxes. So 98% of those wood duck hens are nesting in natural tree cavities. And you know, we think that's probably, if you were to average it across the whole wood duck range across all of Eastern North America, that's probably fairly representative. I think the best estimates I've seen are about 95% are probably using natural cavities. And really that's probably a testament to the, you know, how our forests have matured over the last century. So there was, you know, wide scale clear cutting in the 1900s, a huge decimation of mature old growth forests across Eastern North America and including Minnesota. And over the last century, we've had, a maturation of the forest, and wood ducks are able to find more of that natural nesting habitat in natural cavities. And northern Minnesota is a good example of that.
I'm assuming that a lot of these cavities are created by pileated woodpeckers, which are roughly the same size as a wood duck. And you've kind of elaborated some of the challenges facing the wood ducks right now. Give us a little bit more, maybe, of some of the challenges.
Yeah, they definitely do seem to be keying in on pileated woodpecker, old pileated woodpecker nest sites, which is, yep, you're absolutely right, just about the right size. So they seem to have an entrance where the wood duck can just barely squeeze through, and then in the interior of the cavity, it's plenty big for her to lay her clutch of eggs. And certainly in our study area, we're finding that they're keying in on those old nest sites. So that really relates back to something that Mike North was talking about on your show a couple of weeks ago, where there's almost this nest web, if you will, where there's these primary excavating species that are woodpeckers that are providing this nest site that then other critters that are not able to excavate their own nest sites then use them for their nesting. And that's really kind of a cool ecosystem service, if you will, across our landscape. To go to the populations, we do not survey wood ducks well due to their secretive nature and their forested habitat. So it's hard to count wood ducks and get a great population estimate. There's a few different methods you can do to get around that. Our best information tells us that wood duck populations are pretty stable over the last few decades. So they really were decimated in the 1900s. There was closed hunting seasons for 20 or 30 years. Cavities were gone, like I said. People started using nest boxes. And maybe 60s or 70s, they really started ramping up kind of on an exponential curve. And now, you know, wood ducks have rebounded, and we've got fairly stable populations. So there's, I wouldn't say any major concerns. It's not like, say a grassland species or an aerial insectivore species where there's lots of declines in those types of bird species. Wood ducks seem to be doing fairly well. You know, a few other concerns, though, just to mention, like one thing could be something like emerald ash borer. We were talking about seasonal wetlands. A lot of those are ash swamps where we have ash trees are dominating the canopy. What's going to happen when those forests largely die? That could be a large change to forested wetland habitat for critters like wood ducks in our region.
That was Ed Salonis. He's a DNR wildlife biologist who studies wood ducks and how they are using dead and declining trees. That was part of a series with Mark Jacobs. What I was thinking about is, like, this garden that you planted as part of the Lawns to Legumes project,
yeah,
right, is feeding all of these ants that are coming in and eating these, like, little seeds with their little seed pod thing, or their little fatty thing. And those ants are feeding the woodpeckers, and those woodpeckers are building the nesting cavities for these wood ducks. And just, I love that. And, like, I'm sure that means you get to see so many more insects and birds and wildlife because you have these plants that support all these species.
I think so. I mean, I feel like we're really lucky because we are in town. We're on the edge, but we're still in town. I mean, the pileated woodpeckers absolutely zoom around our yard. So sometimes a little too close. Those get close rather than the red-winged blackbirds. Those get very, very close.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Our pileateds are very shy.
Oh, ours aren't very.
That's interesting.
They get very close, you know, even very close to the car when they're swooping from one end of the driveway to the other, close to my head if I'm sitting out on the patio.
That's a big bird.
It is a big. In talking about feeling bumblebees, you feel a pileated go by your head, and it's like, oh my gosh, what is happening? The funniest thing, and of course the blue jays, who I know some people are annoyed by them, but I just absolutely love them. They're so funny, and they seem to pick fights with everyone, which is very amusing.
I love a rascal, you know, and they're just...
It's so interesting. With the Pileiades, one thing that we notice is every now and then, it's usually a juvenile, I think, Pileiated, because they're nesting all around too. So we have, I don't know, two or three families maybe every summer. The juveniles will come and they'll taste the posts that hold up the deck, but they'll only taste them. So you can see their tongue coming up and they'll be like, oh, this does not taste good. I will not pursue this.
Interesting.
It is. It's funny though, because it's just like, oh.
Why are they tasting the wood?
I don't know. Because
they're not eating the wood. They're eating the insects in the wood.
Yeah, but it's
so why would they be like slurping?
I don't, well, they just like.
So you see their tongue? Out.
Yes, we've seen the tongue just like comes out and it just like, then they're not pecking on it at all for, I suppose maybe because it's treated, but.
I also wonder if there's like some sort of like ant pheromone that they could taste on.
Oh, that makes
the
sense.
The bark or something, but the, you know, the ants are all inside the tree, you know, eating through the dead heartwood. Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. I want to know everything about this.
Yeah. So I'm not entirely sure, but if it's just a matter of landing or some, or whatever they're learning at that point. It looks really funny.
Have you seen any wood ducks nesting nearby?
No, not by our house, but they're definitely around. I thought that was really interesting, though. Only 2% nest in the nesting boxes. That is so interesting.
And those nesting boxes were like so instrumental in recovering the population. And it just makes me think about how so many of our forests are the same age now.
Yeah.
And like, that just is so interesting, biologically speaking, to have like, you know, you kind of see this in humans with like the baby boomer effect of like, there's this huge population that kind of has been moving through. And now we've got tree baby boomers.
It's really neat because you still see people putting up wood duck nests everywhere. And if you're lucky, you can find a wood duck cam, which I absolutely love when the little babies are jumping down. And
For folks who don't know, baby wood ducks and mergansers and a couple other like cavity nesting waterfowl, they nest like in these tree cavities, sometimes 60 feet off the ground. And then you have these baby ducks that can't fly, that need to make their way to water. And there's this great video produced by the BBC. I think it was part of one of the Planet Earth series. But these like little ducklings just have to make this leap of faith 60 feet to the ground. And thankfully, you know, they're light. And the forest floor tends to be covered in leaves and like is relatively soft. But they just make the leap and they just kind of bounce and tumble and then just like pop right up and go running after their mom. But it's so cute. And it's like, what a way to start.
Oh, it is absolutely adorable. I didn't know that as high as 60 feet in the air. I did not know that. That's crazy.
Yeah.
I thought 6 feet was a long way for those little ones.
I'm going to, you know, fact check that really quick. But yeah, I think it's a considerable distance. Wood ducks nest 2 to 60 feet high in trees.
That is amazing.
Nuts.
So when I'm watching these videos, I always think I would be that last duck who's just kind of thinking about it. Like, I don't really want to do that. This seems crazy, Mom. Why?
Yeah.
I mean, watching that plummet is horrifying, but also adorable, and you're just rooting for them the entire time. But
I know.
I would definitely be the last duck.
Heather, this has been an absolute joy. Thank you.
It's always a joy to talk to you. Thank you so much for inviting me on the Season Watch Pod.
We've heard from a number of wonderful people. The red-winged blackbird that we started off the recording with is from Jonathan Jongsba, which was found on Zeno Canto. We heard from our friends at Little Falls Middle School, John Latimer, of course, and then our friends Mark Jacob and Ed Zlonis from the DNR on the wood ducks. Guess what? If you're looking at planting your garden or are looking forward to some insects, send us a note through SpeakPipe. We would love to hear from you. Oh! stop everything. I have something from SpeakPipe that we need to listen to.
Sure. Hi, this is Josh calling in from Bell and Outdoor Science near Afton, Minnesota. And just want to let you guys know that we saw our first bluebirds yesterday, Monday, March 9th. And also heard our first red-winged blackbirds on Monday, March 9th as well. We heard our first sandhill cranes flying over on Thursday, March 5th on site, on the education site. But elsewhere at Bellin on Monday the 2nd, I believe. Also on Monday, March 2nd, we tapped our maple tree. It's a black maple, and we just put in one tap. And so far we've had about 6 gallons of sap up through today, which is Tuesday, March 10th. We also had our first thunderstorm on Friday, March 6th. I'm so excited for Season Watch. We love what you guys are doing. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Josh, for sending that in. Great observations by Josh. Josh is part of the Phenology Investigations in Minnesota Schools program, which I'm a part of through the University of Minnesota. And so I've gotten to work with him quite a bit. He's a joy. So you can, if you'd like, just click about or something where it says kind of the description of the show, it should say, send us a voice memo through SpeakPipe, and click that button and talk to your phone. And then we get to hear from you, which we greatly appreciate.
It's super easy.
Be like Josh.
Yeah, be like Josh. It's so fun to hear your voices.